I just wanted to start with a slide that I didn't quite... This one I didn't quite figure out how to put into my presentation, but I just wanted... I just thought it would be a crime if more people didn't know about this character. This is Kim Arim, also known under her Russian name Alexandra Stankovic. For some reason, that my colours got inverted on this computer. Kim Arim is the first known Korean member of the Bolshevik Party in Russia. Part of the ethnic Korean diaspora there. She joined the Bolsheviks in early 1917, before the February Revolution, and being fluent in Korean and Chinese and Russian was a very important agitator and organizer for them in eastern Russia amongst the Chinese and Korean communities. And for the leading role that she was playing for the Bolsheviks in that area, she was executed by the counter-revolutionary White Armies in August 1918. So a heroic figure that a lot of people don't know about. And I just wanted to sort of mention that because I didn't know where else to put it in my history of North Korea. But I guess it just shows there is... oh, well, I'll get back to it. It shows something. Yeah. So, in Singapore this June, to enormous fanfare, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un signed an agreement to work towards peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. Less than 3 months later, the deal looks to be slipping from Trump's claws. So I guess we watch this space. But remember, it was only 12 months ago that Trump was threatening to unleash nuclear war on North Korea, declaring that he would rain fire and fury and wipe that country off the map. That whole episode marked a dramatic escalation of US warmongering. Now, we all know, of course, the Korean War never actually ended, and every US president has had their turn at saber-rattling against North Korea. But it's been decades since a US president has so openly threatened nuclear war on the country. North Korea's problem, the one thing that prompts US presidents to threaten it with total destruction, is not because it's particularly dictatorial, though it is. You know, there are plenty of horrible dictatorships around the world. North Korea, the US, you know, supports most of them. North Korea's problem is that it's on the wrong side in a long-running battle for power and influence over East Asia. 65 years after the ceasefire was declared in the Korean War, the US still has 28,500 troops stationed permanently in the South. And despite some vague recent kind of offhand remarks about possibly, maybe, potentially being open to discussing a reduction in those numbers, it's obvious that that's all just part of the negotiating tactics during the, you know, in the lead up to the Singapore negotiations. The fact remains, the US is strategically hostile to the notion of withdrawing their forces or weakening their influence in an area of the world that they know is vital for their rivalry with China. So, contrary to all of the media spin, it's fake news, it's not North Korea who are actually refusing to uphold the Singapore Agreement and refusing to contemplate peace. It's actually the US who are pushing this. Now, pointing out that the US are the villains in this story doesn't mean that their opponents are the heroes. North Korea is self-evidently a brutal Stalinist dictatorship where the working class are exploited and oppressed by a parasitical ruling class. And in this case, one that, you know, that literally passes power from father to son like some kind of grotesque dynasty. But that's really as far as most liberal commentators go when they're talking about North Korea, and, you know, keen as they are to demonize America's enemies. Such people present North Korea as simply some kind of relic from the 1950s, a sort of cartoon caricature of high Stalinism, frozen in time. This is a distinctly offensive and actually kind of orientalist view, and it ignores the changes and the contradictions within North Korea, and in doing so, they write out any possibility for change that isn't imposed from without, you know, namely from through American military might. So it should go without saying, but the North Korean regime has changed dramatically since the 1950s. Most obviously, it's now a nuclear power. But it has also weathered the Sino-Soviet split, the collapse of the USSR and the consequent mass famines of the 1990s, and then, more recently, a turn to neoliberal reforms, mostly involving Chinese capital. Neoliberalism in North Korea has created a new layer of ostentatious, super-rich scum, and they've done this through squeezing working-class living standards. The brunt of this has been particularly borne by working class women. And it's this is why women have often been disproportionately drawn into black market trading in cheap, illegally imported consumer goods. They have to do that in order to subsidize their living standards, which have gone backwards in 20 years. This, in turn, also explains why it's working-class women who are disproportionately overrepresented in the ranks of prisoners labelled by the state petty bourgeois counter-revolutionaries for engaging in, you know, free market trading. In 2009, North Korea removed references to communism from its constitution. They replaced it with references to the military first policy, which is a policy that had been in place since the mid-90s. And this policy has seen a deliberate shift of the military to the centre of power, quite an explicit shift. And this shift itself has been driven by the ruling class's recognition that the growing wealth gap in North Korea can easily breed mass rebellion. So today, national service in North Korea has become increasingly grueling and is now quite directly aimed at keeping the country's youth too busy and too exhausted to organise any kind of political opposition or resistance. Now, we can assume all of this has involved social conflict and dislocation. In other words, as I said, there is always the potential for mass resistance inside North Korea. But rather than give a potted history of one Stalinist state over 70 years, you know, which would be probably not that useful, and you could pick any Stalinist regime in the world and give, you know, a potted history of stuff, it's particularly hard in North Korea because it's hard to find information about, you know, resistance and what's actually happening there. So rather than giving that sort of potted history, I thought it's more useful to look at the founding of the North Korean state and the period leading up to it. It's a time of great social struggles and political upheaval when things are in flux and when mass politics really matters. And it's common shorthand on the far left to describe the formation of the North and South Korean states as simply Stalin's tanks roll in and take the North and the US takes the South and, you know, voila, you've got these two dictatorships, and that's kind of as far as it goes. It's all technically true, but it's, I think, too shallow to offer us much understanding. So I'm going to try to go through it in a bit more detail. I think there are important lessons to be learned by looking at the history of Korean communism, how Stalinism took hold, how Kim Il-sung came to power, and how all of this played a part in the awful carnage of the Korean War, a war not of national liberation, but of imperialist rivalry waged over the heads of the Korean civilian population, who were not the leaders of this war, but in all ways its victims. So we might as well start in 1853. Why not? Everything, it's always the thing with a history talk, isn't it? Where does it start? 1853. And it's a seminal moment in early US imperialism, when US warships forced Japan to end its isolation and accept Western trade. At the time, Korea is also closed to foreign trade and has earned itself the disparaging nickname from Westerners, the Hermit Kingdom. And that's obviously a nickname you will have heard being used still today to describe North Korea. But Japan, once it has been forced open, sets off on a rapid, top-down economic and political revolution, the Meiji Restoration. This process turns Japan itself into a rising imperial power. And in 1876, just 23 years after US warships opened Japan, Japanese warships opened Korea. For the next seven decades, Japan asserts its influence over the Korean Peninsula, finally annexing it in 1910 and instituting a brutal military occupation that lasts until the end of World War II. Along the way, of course, Koreans resist, and the armed struggle really takes off through the 1890s. It's just a selection of armed peasants. In 1919, as the great wave of liberation struggles sweep across Asia, Korea explodes in a mass anti-colonial uprising. In this brief window, when millions are on the streets and when you can publish revolutionary literature with slightly less repression than usual, the first Korean communist organizations appear. And they're drawing their inspiration explicitly from revolutionary Russia. Now, this is obviously a key development, but the space is short-lived as the Japanese military quickly crack down. Consequently, the 1920s in Korea are a tragic history of communist parties being founded and then quickly and brutally smashed up by the Japanese forces. Year after year, another batch of brave, heroic revolutionaries are arrested, tortured, and executed. Between 1920 and 1927, there's something like 8 different communist parties are formed in Korea, and all of them are smashed up and brutally put down by the Japanese occupying forces. By 1928, there are essentially no communists left in Korea, at least none who have managed to build any kind of organization. Hundreds, possibly thousands of communists spend many years in the Japanese prisons. Most of their leaders have been broken by repeated torture and forced confessions, and many are simply executed or disappeared. Korean communism, by the end of the 1920s, exists only among exiles, expats, and refugees. There are groups in Russia and in Japan itself, but most of them are in China, where they are under the sway of the Chinese Communist Party. In 1930, these Korean communists in China are based in 3 disparate areas. There's a tiny group down here in Shanghai who are mostly... Shanghai, since 1919, has been the centre of the Korean Provisional Government in exile. So most of the Korean communists in Shanghai, by the end of the 1920s, are the remnants of sort of earlier exiles, or they're communists who have gone to Shanghai for a particular political purpose. Now, the Korean Provisional Government in exile is the main bourgeois nationalist force. It's mostly powerless, but it continues to have a gravitational pull for a lot of Korean exiles. Many of these exiled communists in the early 20s saw their key priority as winning the leadership of the KPG. Now, this is an approach that becomes increasingly absurd in Shanghai through the 1920s. It is, after all, right here in Shanghai in April 1927 that the KPG's Chinese counterpart, the Kuomintang, launched their vicious counter-revolution with the slaughter of thousands of Chinese militant workers and communists. If any single event should have made clear the lunacy and the scandal of the Comintern's policy in China of allying with the supposedly progressive sections of the capitalist class, surely this was it. There's a second group of Korean communists in China who are off the map here in Yunnan. And they're mostly they're a group of highly organized Korean guerrillas who are operating in the stronghold of the CCP. Yunnan is the final destination of Mao's Long March. It's where the CCP is now based. And these Korean communists there are basically Maoist guerrillas, explicitly so. They're worth mentioning here because years later, in 1945, these Yunnan communists, the Korean communists in Yunnan, march across to the border to enter North Korea so they could join the state there. You know, they have this idea that North Korea is now their glorious communist homeland. They have permission from the Russians to enter North Korea in 1945, but they find themselves at the border shocked when Kim Il-sung's own troops surround them and disarm them and put them under arrest. So it's a useful little straw in the wind, perhaps the first example of Kim Il-sung's determination to wipe out rivals within his party. But nonetheless, the survivors of that Yunnan group of Maoist communists, Stalinists, all of them, do end up playing a key role in the establishment of the North Korean state, despite having many of their remaining members purged and even executed as Kim Il-sung consolidates power in the late 40s. And finally, there are several groups of Korean communists operating here in exile, around in the region of Manchuria, or formerly known as Manchuria. Which borders Korea, has that long land border with Korea. Korea only has one other land border, which is a tiny little kind of 10-mile stretch that borders Russia. So for all intents and purposes, that's the land border with China. The groups that have been in exile there by 1931 have at least been trying to build a party of workers, a communist party of workers. They've even led some significant strikes. But in 1931, Japan annexes Manchuria and infamously sets up their own puppet state, Manchukuo. And they forcibly drive the remnant Korean communists from Manchuria's urban centres into rural armed guerrilla detachments. It's from among those guerrillas in Manchuria that Kim Il-sung emerges. So I'm going to focus on what happened there and how it contributed to the later formation of the North Korean Stalinist state. In 1930, even before the Japanese occupy Manchuria, the Chinese government's repression of the Korean communists there has led the desperate Koreans to dissolve themselves into the CCP. We may never know whether the initiative for this came from the Korean communists, the Chinese communists, or from the Comintern, but either way, it represents a pivotal moment for Korean communism. The CCP by this stage has abandoned genuine Marxism, and as has the Comintern. As the years go by, the Comintern has turned into its opposite, no longer a determined, if not always successful, attempt to build mass revolutionary parties and to foster international revolution, but increasingly a vehicle solely for the pushing the foreign policy interests of the Stalinist bureaucracy. Internationally, the Comintern will soon go on to preside over a shameful refusal to fight the rise of Hitler in Germany and all of the other sordid operations of Stalinism through the 1930s. In China in 1930, not content with having played a treacherous role in the bloody defeat of the 1927 Workers' Revolution, Stalin's Comintern are now pushing their third period policies. In Manchuria, this fits with the putschist militarism of CCP leader Li Lisan. So between May and November in 1930, to celebrate the fusion of the Korean Communists and the CCP, they stage a series of ridiculous and futile uprisings in Manchuria, directed at the Chinese government and the Japanese military. But far from driving out the Japanese army or overthrowing the Chinese government, the key outcome of these uprisings is simply the final smashing of the Korean Communists' urban working class membership in Manchuria. This involves the death of up to 3,000 Korean Communists, and the consequent transformation of the Korean Communists of Manchuria into a decidedly Maoist organisation where revolution comes through people's war rather than through working class power. From that point on, the Korean Communists in Manchuria operate primarily as guerrillas, staging skirmishes with the Japanese military and occasionally just blowing stuff up. And all of this, remember, is before before the Japanese military formally annexes Korea. So the situation is, needless to say, pretty hopeless, and none of the Korean Communists have the anti-Stalinist politics needed to even approach finding a way forward. By late 1935, one of these Korean guerrilla bands in Manchuria, though not a particularly notable one, is under the leadership of a young guy called Kim Il-sung, and he's only in his early 20s at this stage. Much of his history is totally false. It's written years later by himself or by his acolytes, and is both based on total fabrication. Even his name is fake. The real Kim Il-sung was actually a popular folk hero, like a Robin Hood-type character. Anyway, it is true that Kim is leading one of these anti-Japanese guerrilla detachments, and they operate within the Northeast Anti-Japanese United Army, which is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, and it's the CCP who train Kim. Unfortunately for Kim Il-sung, all of this Chinese history doesn't sit well in his make-believe tale of leading a glorious Korean national struggle. So his version of history focuses instead on massively overstating the importance of a group that he would help found a year later in 1936 called the Korean Fatherland Restoration Association in Manchuria. I'm just going to call that the FRA, the Fatherland Restoration Association. Now this group, even by Kim's own account, is not an explicitly communist detachment. It's a Korean nationalist group, and it's established in Manchuria to unite a few Korean bourgeois nationalist groups with a literal handful of free-floating Korean Stalinists. This tiny group's 10-point manifesto never mentions Marxism or communism, and it focuses instead on calls for Korean independence from Japan. Self-declared communists in the FRA have no connection at all to any of the organisations or individuals who had previously represented or sought to represent Korea at the congresses of the Comintern. The very first edition of the FRA's paper in December 1936 proudly celebrates the participation in the front of a group called Chondokyo, which is one of the most reactionary organisations of the Korean big bourgeoisie. They are infamous for their failed attempt to conciliate with the Japanese occupiers. Kim Il-sung, nonetheless, welcomes Chondokyo representatives into his tiny organisation, and later he paints it all as some kind of grand communist exercise. And that's mostly about trying to style himself retrospectively as a Korean communist leader, a hero, despite never having actually been a member of a single Korean communist organisation. Anyway, the FRA is tiny, and it's all washed up within about 8 months. And shortly after that, Kim disappears for a few years, and when he marches across from Russia across the Manchurian border into Korea in 1945, as an unknown figure, totally disconnected from the existing Korean communist organisations, he comes with Russian tanks, Russian soldiers, wearing a Russian uniform, and declares to the crowd, "Long live the Soviet Army, long live General Stalin." Though in classic Stalinist style, some years later, the transcripts are changed and the photos are airbrushed to make it all feel a bit more Korean. But we'll get to 1945 in a minute. First, it's worth asking whether things might have turned out differently in Manchuria. The Korean communists in the 1930s faced enormous difficulties, it's true. Exiled, persecuted, hunted by the Japanese military, by the Chinese police, and we haven't even mentioned the Kuomintang's fascist militia, the Blue Shirts. China in the 1930s was in a protracted and multi-sided war, with various colonial powers and warlords also in the mix, and the Japanese invasion only made things even messier. There's no doubt it would have been a difficult place to organise, throwing up political questions that the communist movement hadn't grappled with previously. It confused and tore apart many decent socialist groups, and the ever-changing but constantly disastrous advice coming from the Comintern didn't help either. And to be navigating all of that as exiles, as refugees, would only have further compounded the problem. It's no wonder that the Korean communists didn't get everything right, or frankly, much right at all. But having said that, the key problem they faced wasn't simply those difficult circumstances, it was rather a political problem. There is simply no evidence, at least not in English language sources, that the Korean communists in the 1920s or 1930s had any significant engagement with anti-Stalinist politics. And this is the real tragedy of Korean communism. It didn't have to be that way. By the 1930s, for example, there was a significant, though often overlooked, Trotskyist current in China, organising in opposition to the Maoist CCP. They were a harried minority, and the leadership spent most of the 1930s in jail, but they counted among their numbers some of the most important figures of Chinese Marxism, including Chen Duxiu, a founding member of the CCP, a former Central Committee member, and a close associate of Trotsky himself. The Chinese Trotskyists did have an armed wing. They had many armed wings, actually, or several, like Wang Shangyao and Zhang Sanjie's 2,000-strong Trotskyist battalion in Shandong province, which the Communist Party's Red Army destroyed in 1939, executing 150 Trotskyist cadres. But the Chinese Trotskyists differed from all these other forces by maintaining their commitment to the primacy of workers' revolution and, importantly, maintaining their base in the urban centre of Shanghai, when everyone else in the country prioritised the armed struggle. In doing so, they kept alive a flame that was only finally extinguished by Mao's post-revolutionary regime, whose police arrested hundreds of them in 1952, executing many and keeping the rest in jail for over 25 years. But we have to ask, I think, if the Chinese Trotskyists had been able to build an organisation that was capable of surviving that and navigating that properly, and if they had been able to win over some of the Korean communists, well, obviously, the post-war history for both China and Korea may well have turned out quite differently. At the end of the day, though, the politics of Stalinism dominate the Korean communist movement in China. And this means that even as the prominent Korean communist exiles return after World War II, they are doubly cursed. First, their mistaken view that Stalin's Russia is a liberatory force means they are caught by surprise when Russia's man in Pyongyang turns on them. And second, their essentially counter-revolutionary politics means that they are in no position to lead the post-war Korean upsurge, which does take off in both the North and the South and is repressed in both the North and the South. So let's look at what happened in 1945 and how Kim Il-sung takes power. As World War II draws to a conclusion through 1945, the Japanese imperial forces retreat across Asia. Puppet states fall, and in their place, moments for genuine liberation appear. Like in post-war Europe, it's often the Stalinized communist parties or the Western forces who wind down or put down those movements. In Europe, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill had already decided, which great power would gain which part of the continent. But in the case of Korea, though they all have designs on it, no side has indisputably claimed it. The major powers have only agreed that there will be some kind of, quote, joint trusteeship over the peninsula. Not self-determination by the Korean people, but joint trusteeship over them. On August 2nd, 4 days before the US bomb Hiroshima, Russian troops enter Korea. And they bring with them their token Korean, Kim Il-sung. In response to their presence, US President Truman issues General Order No. 1, decreeing that Japanese troops north of the 38th parallel should surrender to Russian forces, while those south of the 38th parallel should surrender to US forces. And with that, the peninsula was effectively now partitioned, And Stalin is reportedly quite happy with his arrangement, but again, nobody asked the Koreans. US forces don't arrive in the south until almost a month later, on the 8th of September. And in that one-month period, the south explodes into the beginnings of what might have become a revolutionary movement if only there was an organization willing and able to lead it. Many factories and other workplaces are under workers' control. Local people's committees spring up to coordinate production and distribution. It's the beginnings of self-government. At this time, communism is actually much stronger in the south. It's centered on Seoul. The north is more industrialized and perhaps should have been more of a focus, but Seoul remains the political heart and is a beacon for revolutionaries from across the peninsula. Soon enough, the only communists even left in the north are insignificant individuals and careerists who quickly fall in line behind Kim Il-sung. But even those communists who are in the south show little interest at all in pushing the nascent revolutionary movement further. Even as the US strengthens its hold on the south, many of these southern Korean communists are more focused on shoring up their own future political careers in the belief that some kind of democratic state is about to form. Among them are assorted rats who can see which way the wind is blowing and suddenly make public denunciations of their own decades of communist activism. Others, assuming that the Russians will welcome them, drift north, where the chosen ones are taken into the embryonic Stalinist state, but those who are deemed to be potential rivals to Kim Il-sung are purged, jailed, or disappeared. Meanwhile, the US moves to crack down on the South Korean class struggle. Like a mirror image of the Russians, the US have selected their own Korean exile, Syngman Rhee, to be president of a new South Korean state. And in October 1945, they fly him from Washington to Seoul in Douglas MacArthur's private jet. In December, the US military bans the South Korean People's Committees, but it takes them another 6 months and mass arrests to finally subdue them. In the final burst of resistance in Seoul, the US authorities and their Korean puppets slaughter thousands of workers. In the north, resistance and demands for independence are also taking shape. In fact, the movement up there is not all that different to what's happening in the south. But shamefully, much of the international left will go on to ignore this resistance, or worse, to dismiss it all as reactionary. In the first few days after the Japanese surrender, hundreds of political prisoners in the north are released from Japanese prisons. In Hamgyong province, they storm local government buildings and occupy them, demanding immediate transfer of power from the Japanese to Koreans. The Northern Workers' Movement also surges forward. In the provinces of Hamgyong, Haeju, and Hwanghae, a number of factories drive out their Japanese bosses and put their workplaces under workers' control. But in all these instances, and right across the north, the Russian troops stifle the rebellious activity with forceful decrees to maintain public order. They ban public protest, they even use deadly force on occasion to suppress it, and they censor radical newspapers, including even those that are pro-Moscow. In both the north and the south, the Stalinized communist parties refuse to lead the resistance struggles, and they seek to demonize them. In the northern province of Hamgyong, where those occupied factories eventually raise the slogans of factories to the workers, committees for poor peasants, and for the founding of workers and peasants Soviets, the Communist Party denounces it all as leftist deviations, and they actively suppress it. It's also worth noting that the Russian occupation of the north, just like the south, is a military occupation. A former officer in the North Korean People's Army describes what this means. He writes of Russian soldiers looting, raping, and murdering across the north. He writes, quote, "This state of affairs was the same in small and medium-sized towns wherever the soldiers were stationed. This was not the logic of an army of liberation, but the logic of an invading army. Phrases like Great Red Army thieves and Go Home Russians could be heard everywhere." And that's a North Korean army officer talking. The Russian army itself even acknowledges this in a report to Moscow, where they also note the high number of rapes and murders, and they conclude with this remark. "The occasional immoral behaviour of our soldiers stationed in our North Korean territory is provoking discontent among the local population." Note the words there, our North Korean territory. It's true that the Russian occupying forces in the north aren't massacring the People's Committees like the US is doing in the south, but they certainly aren't letting those committees maintain any independence. On the contrary, the People's Committees are being put under the authority of Moscow. And they're finding this isn't very difficult to do because most of these committees are dominated by pro-Moscow Stalinists. Those few committees that aren't pro-Moscow are simply reorganized from on high to better reflect Stalin's desire to have a subservient local authority. In fact, in the south, where the people's committees are also overwhelmingly communist-dominated, but much more active, the committees there actually declare a people's republic, and they request that Moscow give them authority over the whole peninsula. But Moscow doesn't want to risk damaging their relationship with the US over the issue of the 38th parallel, and they know they don't actually control those committees anyway, so they refuse. Amidst all this resistance and repression, the world's new superpowers, the two sides of the new Cold War, consolidate their own respective puppet states, North and South. Kim Il-sung purges and executes his opponents, and Syngman Rhee does likewise. As we know, in 1930, it flares into a hot war between North and South, which in its 3 years of active hostilities will result in around 5 million people dying, the majority of whom will be civilians from either side. This war will not be a national liberation struggle like we will see later in Vietnam, but a war between powerful rivals over who will control East Asia and the Pacific. Now, at the time, that would have been a controversial statement. Many revolutionary socialists around the world would have disagreed. At the time, much of the Trotskyist Fourth International argued forcefully that the war in Korea was a national liberation struggle and that it was part of an Asian anti-colonial revolution. And this debate becomes a key factor in splitting the post-war Trotskyist movement. But nonetheless, they were wrong. This was not a national liberation struggle. It does seem that the Northern armies initially spark some kind of popular uprising as they sweep through the South, pushing all the way to the southern coastal city of Busan within just 3 months. There is some evidence that the southern population, so hateful of the brutal US occupation, harboured some illusions in the communist North, at least in those early days. But this uprising is extremely small, extremely brief, and only lasts a matter of weeks. It's not on a scale that really warrants the description of an uprising. It's more just an expression of hope for something better. Once the retaliatory US invasion begins, the war immediately transforms into a regular conflict between superpowers. Within 2 months, the US forces have marched all the way to the northern border with Manchuria, smashing up any remnants of what might have been a popular resistance on the way. In response to the threats to their own borders, the new Maoist regime in China sends in hundreds of thousands of troops, and for the next 3 years, it's essentially US forces fighting Chinese and Russian forces over the heads of the Korean population. The US and its allies, including Australia, would go on to destroy entire cities, to deploy napalm against civilians, and to commit innumerable war crimes and massacres. And in the end, after all of that killing, all of that destruction, both sides withdraw to the 38th parallel, exactly where they'd been 3 years earlier. This standoff, not actually peace, just a long-running, decades-long ceasefire, will remain as the front line of the Cold War for several decades. But even now, in 2018, that standoff may well continue for some time yet, as the US and China jostle for influence in the region. And so long as the rivalry of great powers over Korea continues, the solution too can only remain the same. The only hope for genuine peace, for reunification and for liberation remains with the struggles of the oppressed and the exploited in the North and the South, and in their revolution against all of the regimes that have long waged war on them and over them.